You're listening to the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 28, recorded Sunday, March 11th, 2012. App Economy. The new iPad further strengthens the foundation of the app economy. There are more iOS-related jobs than ever before, and my guest on this show is Martin Pilkington, who just sold an app to get his own app economy in order. And the latest gate in Apple's history is OpenStreetMap gate. Apple commissioned a study by Analysis Group about their impact on the US economy. Based on the results, Apple launched an interesting page which summarizes the facts. The study found that Apple has directly or indirectly created 304,000 US jobs. These jobs, spread across all 50 states, include thousands of jobs in numerous industries, from the people who create components for our products to the people who build the planes and trucks that carry them to our customers. For example, this figure also includes workers in Texas who manufacture processors for iOS products, Corning employees in Kentucky and New York who create the majority of the glass for iPhone, and FedEx and UPS employees, together with the 210,000 iOS jobs generated by the app economy. These 304,000 jobs make a total of 514,000 US jobs created or supported by Apple. With more than 550,000 apps and more than 24 billion downloads in less than 4 years, the App Store has created an entirely new industry: iOS app design and development. The app revolution has added more than 210,000 iOS jobs in the US economy since the introduction of iPhone in 2007, and Apple has paid more than $4 billion in royalties to developers through the App Store. We also provide app developers with the tools and distribution they need to bring their best ideas to tens of millions of iOS customers worldwide. The number of Apple jobs based in the US has more than quadrupled over the past decade, from less than 10,000 employees in 2002 to more than 47,000 today. That number more than doubles again when we include vendors that employ more than 50,000 people who directly support Apple. These jobs require people with a wide variety of skills, including construction workers, component manufacturers, retail specialists, tech support representatives, salespeople, marketers, and the best hardware and software engineers in the world. End quote. Then they also mention how almost all of the 246,000 retail jobs are full-time and not seasonally hired, and how proud they are of having their telephone support based in the US instead of India, where it would cost half as much. Pixeldot.com, spelled PXLDOT.com, has a great analysis how soon after launch customers will have updated their devices to a new iOS version. They correlate it also with how the story looks on Android. But what's most interesting for us iOS developers is this: about 20 weeks after release, 75% will have upgraded. And about 40 weeks after launch, we can assume that almost 100% of devices will be on the new iOS version. Then there is a long tail of some devices that will never get updated, like the original iPhone I gave to my in-laws as a normal mobile phone. Those are dropping off around 3% per week. There's a chart about that that I added to the show notes. Today we are at 21 weeks after launch of iOS 5, and the chart you see that indeed iOS 5 is around slightly more than 75%. There are two nice learnings from this. If you start a new project, it almost never makes sense to support iOS versions that are older than the previous major release. And if you're planning ahead and, for example, plan for launch in 3 months from now, then you can even not bother with iOS 4. Long story short, we are extremely lucky that Apple apparently has a strategy that gets the software modernized as quickly as possible, contrary to Android, where so many factors prevent a quick and widespread adoption of new versions of the operating system. Somebody should make a website that takes this formula and counts down the approximate percentage of devices on a given iOS version. Wink, wink. The same Martin Pilkington that I'm going to interview in a few minutes launched FixRadar or GTFO.com, which about 300 developers are supporting so far. The idea is to demonstrate to Apple that we developers would like for them to improve the bug reporting site, also known as Radar. To join the effort, all you have to do is create a new Radar, copy in the open letter featured on the site, and if you like, add the bug number and your name to the ever-growing list of supporters. Let me read to you the first paragraphs. The only way to really communicate with Apple about what is broken and what we want is Radar. But Radar sucks and has done for a very, very long time. This puts a lot of people off filing Radars. The user interface is awkward and slow. We have to stop what we are doing and go to a web UI that still thinks we are running macOS 10, 10.1, which makes it awkward to look at bugs we've already filed and generally is un-Apple-like. Radar is also a black hole. We file Radars and we're lucky to hear back about them. Well, I think he meant to say if we are lucky, we hear back about them, because most of the time we don't even do that. Continuing, the majority of Radars are either left untouched or marked as duplicates of other Radars we cannot see. We may get a request for more information from engineering, but sometimes it is for irrelevant information or information already given in the original report. All this makes us feel like our Radars make little difference, and this is important as our time is valuable. We are contractors, and every minute spent filing Radars is time not spent doing client work. We are employees, and every minute spent filing Radars is time not spent writing codes for our employers. We are indies, and every minute spent filing Radars is time not spent writing great apps for our users. We are hobbyists, and every minute spent filing Radars is time spent not doing our hobby and enjoying ourselves. We are developers, and every minute spent filing Radars is time not spent making the great applications that show off how our platforms can be so much more than just what you ship to customers. End quote. The open letter goes on, but I'll leave you to read this on the site when you file your own Radar. After 25 billionth app was downloaded, Apple released lists of the all-time top iPhone and iPad apps, both free and paid. Dan Frommer from SplatF analyzed the list and came up with some interesting facts. Angry Birds is 3 of the top 10 paid iPhone apps, numbers 1, 5 and 8, and 3 of the top 25 free iPhone apps, and 3 of the top 10 paid iPad apps, and 3 of the top 25 free iPad apps. Just incredible. 3 of the top 12 paid iPad apps are Office apps. Apple's iWork suite of Pages, number 1, Numbers, number 11, and Keynote, number 12. Clearly, there is demand for these types of apps, and Microsoft Office is missing out. None of the top apps are location-based services, unless you count Motion X, GPS, Google Earth, or Groupon. 4 of the top 10 paid iPhone apps, Angry Birds, Fruit Ninja, Words with Friends, and Angry Birds Rio, also have free versions in the top 25 free iPhone apps. 7 of the top 10 free iPhone apps have blue as their dominant icon color. Only one, Netflix, has no blue at all. Instagram, a relatively young app, made it to number 19 in the free iPhone apps. That's quite impressive. And Facebook's newish iPad app already made it to number 17 in the free iPad apps. Two-thirds party Facebook apps also made it in the top 25 free and paid iPad apps, reflecting the void Facebook left unfilled for so long. I'm surprised to see bump so high in the top 3 iPhone apps, number 14. Do people actually use this app? Have never seen it. iBooks seems to have been excluded from this list, or is the Kindle iPad app, number 5, in the free iPad apps list, really the only one in the top 25? Seems like a strange exclusion. Average current price of the top 25 all-time paid iPhone apps, $1.51. Average current price of the top 25 all-time paid iPad apps, $5.59. So successful iPad apps are more than 3 times as expensive as iPhone apps. Would you have expected that? The big news this week, obviously, was the announcement of the new iPad, no number, and an Apple TV hockey puck that has a new UI and is able to play 1080p. No surprises. There still is a home button, and now there's really finally a device that will make use of the Add2X images you've been putting into your iPad apps since last fall. You have been shipping Retina-capable iPad apps, right? Right on the heels of the keynote, Apple emailed all makers of catalog apps and informed them that their catalogs have been moved to the new catalog section on iTunes. This was of special interest to me because 18 of the apps mentioned on the front page use my iCatalog framework. We welcome this move, even though Apple decided to do that behind our backs, because it makes it easier for customers to find our catalogs, and also we have a more direct comparison to our competitors. Previously, catalog apps were dispersed in a multitude of categories, which made it impossible to rank them against each other. Now they are all in one convenient place. Apple has released iPhoto for iPhone and iPad. In the new photo journals feature, Apple is not using map tiles from Google, but instead is using OpenStreetMap data with their own custom tiles. So writes OpenStreetMap on their blog. Although Apple seems to have forgotten to add the necessary credit, OpenStreetMap writes, "It's also missing the necessary credit to OpenStreetMap's contributors. We look forward to working with Apple to get that on there." OpenStreetMap gate! Both Google and OpenStreetMap require that map tiles have an annotation of the source. Apple obviously wanted to be able to omit this source information because it looks ugly on people's phone journals. So Apple bought mapping company Poly9 in July 2010. This was the second mapping company they acquired after buying PlaySpace just 1 year earlier. One of these two companies seems to have been secretly copying data from OpenStreetMap and passing it off as their own. The data in question seems to be from early 2010, so that might have been one final desperate attempt by Poly9 to look more attractive to Apple, which worked. The latest fake app in a long series of scam apps is Counter Space Strike. Space I added, because original Counter-Strike is one word, which has a description and screenshots that lead you to believe you are indeed purchasing the well-known shooter. But it is a scam. The actual app you might be getting is a game of some sort, but it's not the real Counter-Strike. The loophole seems to be that you can change description and screenshots after getting approval for an app. Apple checks to see if your app matches your description and will reject the app if it doesn't. This way you can sneak in any app and do a bait and switch right under everybody's nose. This app is rated 9+ for infrequent / mild realistic violence. Probably to warn you that this developer is out to violently abuse your wallet. I fear that this will eventually lead to Apple disabling the ability to modify the description and screenshots after approval, just because somebody peed in the pool everybody loses out. Unfortunately, there is no way to directly inform Apple about such scam apps. Only if you already fell victim, you can follow the guide in a knowledge base article how to report an issue with your iTunes store purchase. So definitely ask for your money back and inform them that the app does not match the description. If enough customers do that, Apple will pull the app. And that's it for the news. Today I've got a special guest, Martin Pilkington from M-Cubed Software. And I like to interview people who are in the same business as ours doing iOS development. But the special case of Martin is that he's just announced that he sold an app to somebody else. And I'd like to know how that worked. So hi, Martin.
Hi.
Hi. So can you maybe, before we get into this news story, tell us a bit about your background? How did you get to develop for the iOS platform, and how long have you been doing that?
Well, I've started back on the Mac, doing Mac development. And I've been doing that for several years. And when iOS came out, it's just a case of, well, it's Cocoa, I want to try and play around with this. And my first experience with doing iOS development was actually at university. Just played around with the SDK. I think it came out in my last year of university and was just playing around with it. And I hadn't really thought about making an app and selling it at that point, but when the iPad came out, it got to the point where I actually got serious about iOS development and probably looked into it and ended up working on an app.
Just a quick thing. Do you have something on your microphone? It sounds a little bit like something is scratching on your on the tip of your microphone.
Because
it like sounds like that.
Now yeah, I can't hear. I don't think so.
Okay, let's just try to continue. So, you came from Mac and got interested in iOS when the iPad was launched, right?
Yeah.
So, was it easy a transition for you to get into UIKit from AppKit?
It was a fairly easy transition to get to the basics. Stuff like buttons, text fields, and stuff worked pretty well. UIKit, when I started with it, I think it was iOS 3 and then iOS 4 was just coming out. That's when I started properly getting into it. And in some ways, it's easier to use than AppKit because it simplifies a lot of things and makes things easier. But at the same time, it was missing functionality I was used to, and it was hard to really get things working the way I wanted them. Now, a lot of the problems I had with it were actually fixed in iOS 5, so they don't actually affect me anymore now, but it was easy enough transitioning because I knew all the stuff. It was just getting all the edge cases of where things are different and how you work with certain classes is differently to how you work with others.
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that you've been on iOS platform for about 3 years now?
Roughly. I mean, I haven't focused on it as much as some people because I've been doing a bit of iOS and a fair bit of Mac work. So, but about 3 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Now, this work that you speak of, you do everything under the name M-Cubed?
Yes.
And so what does this do? Do you have mostly your own apps or do you do contract work as well?
Up until recently, it was mostly just my own apps that I've developed. But recently, I started doing some contract work to just get more experience in different areas, bring some more money in and stuff. So I've started branching into doing more and more contracting work.
Mm-hmm. And so you've got a couple of items on your plate that were too much so that you started selling things and shutting down things? Or Was it kind of different than I just described it?
Well, it's pretty much that. I had five applications. Four of them were Mac applications, and one was my iPad application. And dealing with five applications is a lot on their own anyway. Doing contracting as well to bring in some more money, that's even less time. So it got to the point where I had to start making decisions about what to do with various applications. Now, some of them were easy decisions. One of my Mac applications called Minim has pretty much never made any real money. So that was an easy enough thing to just say, well, I'll stop selling it.
So you're not making anything, you get out of here.
I was making money off my applications. It was just not enough to really survive full time on an indie, as an indie developer. So I needed the contracting to sort of help out.
Ah, yeah. Thank you for your honesty, because most of us have this dream of maybe one day I can make enough with my own apps and then I can go full time. So you seemingly were brutally honest to yourself and decided, well, I need to have the extra income from contracting work.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people that become full-time indies go through it where they start off doing contracting with their own apps and then gradually progress. I started doing my development back when I was 18, and I've been doing it sort of part-time with my education. And as soon as I left university, I was just about earning enough to say I can do this full time. Unfortunately, various things have happened since university and apps have been delayed and so on. So that's meant that the income coming in from the apps has sort of dwindled. And because I've got so many apps and sort of got into the mentality of, well, this app isn't really selling as much as I need, let's make another app. And that mentality sort of got me to the point where I couldn't dedicate enough real time to any individual app. So none of them were getting any real love and attention, which means that none of them were making a lot of money. So it just got to the point where I had to say, well, I've got to get rid of some of these and just focus on a few things so that I can do a few things and do them well rather than spreading myself too thin.
So from five apps, four on the Mac and one on the iPad, you basically announced today that you sold the one for iPad?
Yeah.
And what happened to the other Mac apps? Did you shut down one and keep the remaining three, or what's going to happen there?
Well, I sold Storyboards to my friend Steve Troughton-Smith, who he runs under the company High Caffeine Content. And he's a really good iOS developer. He's done all sorts of things. I mean, half the things you hear about, someone's hacked around with something on the iPhone and figured out how to get Siri to do this or whatever, it's generally him that's done it. So he really knows what he's doing. So it was a case of, and he's really eager to work on it and improve Storyboards. So it's really in good hands. With the Mac apps, it was sort of decided. I mean, as I said, Minim was making no money at all. I think it had like one or two sales in the past year, if that. And it was a case of, it was a good app, I use it, but not many people had a use for it. So rather than still supporting it, I decided I'm going to discontinue it. Core Collector Pro is the other one that I'm stopping selling, but I'm not discontinuing it. And the problem with Core Collector Pro is that Apple's introducing the sandbox on the Mac. And while the sandbox is really good, certain applications do not fit in the sandbox. And some of the APIs I use for core features to communicate and control other applications are not permitted in the sandbox. And from all I can see from Apple, they're never going to be permitted in the sandbox.
But well, isn't it the case that apps that are already on the Mac App Store don't have to obey the sandbox?
To a degree, Apple has said that any bug fix releases can be submitted after the sandbox deadline without adding sandboxing. However, from everything I've read, they imply that feature updates need to have sandboxing. So it's a case of you can still fix bugs without adding sandboxing in, but when you're doing the next big feature release, it needs to have sandboxing. Because I think their intent is, if it's on the Mac App Store, it's sandboxed. Now, I could have sold Core Collector Pro off the store, but the problem is that the sales coming through my website have dropped off a lot since the Mac App Store. Most of my sales are coming through the App Store. So if I can't really be on the App Store and sales aren't coming through as much on the website, it's a case of I just came to the decision that I'm going to open source it and just keep it as a sort of personal project that I work on when I have time.
So what does this app do?
Core Collector Pro is a, it's a developer tool for managing code snippets. So you just get little bits of code that you want to reuse over and over. You put them in, you can store them, and then you can just quickly insert them into code in whichever application you use to write.
Ah, cool. Gotta have a look at that. Before we run out of time, could you maybe give us a bit of background how this sale of the Storyboards app actually came to be? Was it you and your buddy sitting over a beer and you just telling him, I have so much on my plate, don't you want to have something of that? Or how did this came to be?
Well, I went through various things about what to do with Storyboards, because the thing is that Storyboards is a really good concept for an app, but I wasn't really passionate about it and I didn't really know enough about storyboarding to really continue with it. And so initially I was going to sell it off to another developer, but then it was a case of, well, it's really awkward to sell an iOS app. So then I got to the point of, well, I was just going to open source it and discontinue it. But then I was talking to this with Steve, and Steve said, well, why don't you sell it to me? So he does a lot of stuff related to sort of media and video and stuff like that on iOS. So it seemed like a good fit, and I knew I could trust him to look after the customers and develop it into a great application. So we started talking and decided to sell it, and then got to the difficult bit of how do you actually go through all the technical stuff of transferring an application. And the problem is, at the moment, you don't.
Yeah, you can't. You just have to the option to get remove the app from the previous owner's account, or basically take it away from sales and then publish it on the new account with a new application identifier.
Yeah, I think he's selling it as Storyboards for iPad now. I mean, rather annoyingly, when I first started selling Storyboards, and I have no idea how it happened, it must be a bug in iTunes, that there are actually two iPad applications, both called Storyboards. And both had the same name, and somehow that got through Apple's review process or whatever. So, but he's had to change the name of it to Storyboards for iPad so it doesn't clash. And he's selling it at a discount price at the moment because there's no way to actually transfer licenses over when you sell something, which is really something Apple really needs to solve, because it isn't that rare an occurrence that someone will acquire an application that you have to resort to everyone rebuying the application in order to transfer people over.
Yeah, so it's a bit sad.
Yeah.
And it's as the market matures more and more, you will have more and more developers who want to kind of optimize as you did.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, the App Store has got to the point where for most of the basic use cases, it is a really good system. But it's just all these edge cases that we're used to. Like, we can now do bulk sales to educational institutions, but you can't do bulk sales and bulk discounts to businesses, for example.
Yeah, actually, I had this problem just today. Somebody wanted to buy a volume license for Lingwan, my translation tool for Mac. And we did a bit of research, and true, you can only bulk license Apple software, can't bulk license third-party software, which is sad.
And the thing is that, like for Mac apps on the Mac App Store, an individual can buy a piece of software and use it on as many computers as they want, but the license agreement says that if a business buys it, they've got to then buy it each time. Now, that makes sense. However, you can't give any discount, and it isn't a case of there's no real way to really manage downloading it once and distributing it so that everything is up to date. So it's kind of, they need to get around to fixing all these edge cases with the App Store, with bulk discounts, with selling applications. Trials is another big thing that they need to sort out. So hopefully over time, Apple will improve it, because as they've shown with the App Store, since its release, they have improved it quite a lot and fixed stuff. I mean, the other really key thing that is a frustration is you don't know who has bought your software, and there's no way to communicate with them. So I cannot tell existing users of Storyboards, hey, someone else has acquired it. If you want to continue getting updates, you're going to have to go and get it from them. They're just completely in the dark on it until they maybe notice it on a website somewhere.
And how about doing a last final update on the previous app with a notice panel that says there's now a new owner and you have to buy it there to continue?
That's something that I might consider doing. The only problem with that is, in order to do that, it has to actually be available in the store to buy. Which,
yeah, but it's not anymore at the moment.
Well, yeah, it's had to be taken down, because otherwise they can either buy it from me, but if they buy it from me, then they've got to rebuy it from Steve to get the update. So it's sort of a case of, it's confusing. I mean, it would be good if you could discontinue selling an app, but continue adding, like fixing bugs or whatever, do releases that aren't actually, it isn't on the store to buy, but existing users are still supported.
Or how about making it free? And just putting in the description, this is only meant as a placeholder. Actually, the new software is over there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of thing that would be nice to do, but will it get through the review process?
You can change the review text or the description after the thing is approved.
True.
We did that several times. Let me ask you one final question that I'm really lusting to ask you. When you sold the app, did you ever kind of get the idea, well, maybe I'm not selling it, I'm just giving it to Steve, and he does a sort of revenue sharing? Or was it like you always said, I'm going to sell it and then be done with it?
It was always going to be, I'll sell it and be done with it. I mean, it's as much a case of, I want to get the workload off my plate so that I can focus on my existing apps, my contracting, and there's other small projects I want to do that aren't actually, they're related to like developing software, but they aren't actually writing code. So it's wanting to get onto those things and branch out rather than having things lingering on for several months more.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I lied. That's not the final question I want to ask. The really final question is, did you apply any sort of formula to take the annual sales and convert that into a sales price? Or how did you arrive at the amount that you got for it? If you can share it.
The amount that I got for it,
don't have to say the exact amount, but if I were to sell an app of mine, how would you calculate the value?
Well, I actually sold storyboards fairly cheaply, but the normal formula that I use for pricing up the value of an application is 2 times the last year's sales.
Ah, that's good,
So
yeah.
if an application says made $5,000 in the past year, the source code is worth $10,000.
Okay, so you
So
made like $2 million with
I wish.
Storyboard. You wish. All right. I think you have to go now, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's leave it at that. I think it was very nice having you on the show. Maybe you can come back in a future episode as well. And I wish you good luck with your now optimized portfolio.
Thank you.
And be seeing you. Are you going to come to NS Conference?
Unfortunately, I won't be at tennis conference, but I will be at iOS Dev UK. Hopefully, I'll be giving a talk there.
When is that?
I think it is in July. Let me just check for the.
So after WWDC.
Yeah, it is. Let's see, 10th to 12th of July in Aberystwyth in Wales.
Ah, interesting. The UK is quite busy with iOS development and conferences, it seems.
Yeah, it's getting quite good now. It's makes a change from having them all in the US and not being able to go to any of them, and then finally having all these pop up in the UK and in Europe, and having some of the focus come a bit closer to home where it's cheaper to travel to.
Well, I'm very much for that, being from Central Europe myself, and it's much easier to attend conferences in the UK. Okay, that's it for my interview with Martin. Thank you for being on the show again, and well, be seeing you.
Thanks. Goodbye.